Michael Jacobson, the president and CEO of the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association. Michael, I'll bet you are busy these days.
Indeed, but busy is always better than bored, so we'll take it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, summer in Chicago is always a high time for the hotel business, but this year, I'm thinking NASCAR's only in its second year. The DNC is back. You've got Lollapalooza and everything else. How are the hotels doing?
We're really excited. It's going to be a very strong year. I think you'll see a lot more announcements around record revenues on particular weekends. And you didn't even mention some of them. We had the restaurant show that had great numbers. And then we even have, this is an even year. So we have our biggest convention that comes every 2 years called IMTS, the big manufacturing show, that brings over 100,000 people right after the DNC moves out. So all this hoopla has been made about the DNC, which is well-deserved, and we're really excited about it. But a couple weeks after they move out, a new convention moves in that's double the size of the DNC. So it's going to be a great summer that is going to be one for the ages.
50,000 and 100,000. It's pretty amazing that the city can absorb them. I mean, I'm downtown every day, and I'll see people with lanyards. I sometimes see the buses taking conventioners from the Sheraton or someplace near the radio station. But the city has room for that many people. It's amazing.
We do. I was talking to a convention planner this morning with the National Restaurant Association in Forman. They were saying that, I mean, just look at Chicago. It's one of the only cities that's built for this. You look at our convention, it's not only the largest, it's always ranked as one of the best convention centers in North America. That's why we're on the radar, so many convention planners. And yes, there's been a lot of talk about, has convention travel come back? It hasn't come back to full pre-pandemic levels, but we're having a lot of even short-term wins. People that are booking conventions, even for later this year, like Microsoft, we're having a lot of short-term wins to make up for the losses that we experienced during the pandemic. Keep in mind, when it was really hard to sell McCormick Place as a convention center when it was shut down altogether. So there was a little bit of a lag there, and we're really picking up the pace of bookings to fill for that hole.
Do you wish that McCormick Place were further north along the lake, if it was just a little closer to the restaurants and hotels?
You know what? Even look at the McCormick Place complex. That's actually where I'm calling in from, right next door at the Hilton's at McCormick Place right now. Look at the development that's happened down in the South Loop. You're really seeing the benefits of the convention center, not just benefit River North or the Loop. It's really, the impact has really spread out even into the neighborhood that traditionally didn't have hotels but have benefited from our increase in tourism in the city.
I wonder if the Chicago Sky are going to show up in some metric in the near future, since they've been doing so much better. And anytime that team from Indiana comes in, you got 10,000 people at Wintrust, right?
Indeed. And it's really cool, even with the WNBA schedule, that it's not like some of the other sports leagues where that team only comes in town once or twice a year. We get it kind of regularly. And the rivalry that's developed, not even just with Indiana, but with some of the other teams across the country. I do think a year ago we were talking about the Taylor Swift impact on tourism. Now we're going to be talking about the WNBA impact on tourism. I think it's a really great trend for us.
So the Sun-Times says that a room in Chicago, on average, for the DNC is $535. Does that sound about right to you?
You know what? We don't have the ability to kind of measure rates in real time. There's no mechanism to do that. We would get our data afterwards. But anytime any sort of convention like that comes into town, you do see it's a nature of supply and demand. You see rates go up as occupancy fills up.
I wonder then, I mean, I'd like to go downtown, spend a weekend or a couple of days in the city, but maybe I don't want to drop $1,000 for a couple of nights. And that's the average. So there are hotel rooms, I presume, that are less expensive. But what advice do you have for people who are looking for value in a hotel in the city?
You know what? There's always deals to be had. I mean, if you want to come down and see the fireworks at Navy Pier on Saturday or just to enjoy a day downtown, there's plenty of weekends throughout the summer that and even throughout the DNC, there will be deals to be had, especially as we get a little bit closer to the date. So I wouldn't let price be the deterrent to going online and seeing what's available about downtown. Obviously, every weekend's going to change based on what else is in town. But I wouldn't let price be the deterrent of booking a last-minute trip from the suburbs or even from Indiana or Wisconsin to come downtown to the city.
Do you know what the occupancy rate is? Is there a number for last month or this year in the hotels?
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the bright spots. You look at even just, we just got the May 2024 numbers and just from last month, and a lot of regions throughout Illinois actually saw a year-on-year decline. Chicago did not. It was 76% occupancy last month compared to 71% in 2023. And what I'll say is that, yes, that's a year-on-year increase, but we still aren't at that pre-pandemic occupancy level. We measure two big metrics in the hotel industry: occupancy, how many rooms are actually filled, and then average daily rate, what we're actually charging for our hotels. Rates met pre-pandemic levels several years ago, of course, because of inflation. The cost of just everything related to our business is much higher than it was 5 years ago. But the occupancy rate, our analysts actually have pushed back that expectation to hit that pre-pandemic level to 2028. So we're doing much better than where we were, but we're still not quite back to that pre-pandemic level quite yet.
Michael Jacobson is the president and CEO of the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association. Actually, a little later on in the show today, we're going to give people a tour of the Palmer House Hilton and tell them about the cool things going on there. So more to come. Continued success to you all, Michael.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Michael Jacobson from the Hotel and Lodging Association. Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET.com, and she does not have $2 trillion. But she knows who does. What's going on, Bree?
Yeah, Amazon's value, it hit the $2 trillion mark yesterday. It's a very exclusive club of just a few companies that have hit that kind of valuation.
So that's the stock price times the number of shares out there, huh?
Yeah. It's your market cap, your, you know, estimated value in the eyes of Wall Street. You know, Amazon now joins companies like Google's parent Alphabet, Microsoft, Apple, and of course, NVIDIA, with hitting valuations of at least $2 trillion. I just checked their shares now, and they're just under that right now, but their shares are up for the day.
Is that, though, kind of interesting in that at least those other companies, Alphabet, Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, they make things. Amazon, mm-hmm. I think of as just a retailer. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, Amazon does a lot more than just, you know, ship you your stuff within 24 hours. They have also AWS, which is huge, you know, kind of behind the scenes hosting a lot of, you know, companies' data, things like that. That is where a lot of their money comes from. And then also they're investing heavily in AI now, just like a lot of other tech companies, and hoping that that'll bear fruit eventually.
Does Amazon Prime fall under the umbrella of Amazon value?
Definitely. You know, things like, you know, your Prime membership and all that money they're going to make on Prime Day, you know, cleaning out their warehouses, that all kind of goes into the under the same umbrella. And it's also worth mentioning that Amazon has made money by cutting costs lately. They've laid off tons of people since late 2022, about 27,000 corporate employees, and that fall under a bunch of different divisions.
So what does that say about the company?
Well, Wall Street loves layoffs. You and I may not like that, but, you know, Wall Street shares go up when people lose their jobs. It's kind of sad. But, you know, Wall Street looks at that as, you know, smart spending, and lower costs mean higher profits.
They're also partnering with Megan Thee Stallion. So the discount days, the Prime days are July 16th and 17th this year. Is that right?
Yep, this is what I call the world's largest garage sale. They're getting rid of, you know, lots of different things. And it's always big. There's so much promotion. And they're partnering with hip-hop star Megan Thee Stallion. There's commercials airing now. She has a rap song that's all about Prime Day. So, you know, the promotion is starting early and going hard on this to get people to just buy stuff.
Maybe I'll put off making a purchase. Are there certain categories or products that are, you know, worth waiting for July 16th and 17th?
You know, it remains to be seen. Certainly big ticket stuff. I mean, you're going to want to look at 4th of July sales, of course, this week. But then, yeah, Amazon, if you're going to buy Amazon branded things, they're almost always the cheapest during Prime Day. You know, if you need like an Alexa smart speaker, something like that, you can always find good deals. I mean, CNET will definitely have a whole bunch of coverage as to what the good deals are. But you have to remember, too, a lot of other companies have competing sales. Walmart is actually going to do theirs the week before this year. So, you know, it's best to shop around, just like always.
What do you say about this Supreme Court ruling? The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the Biden administration wasn't censoring or too much infringing on the First Amendment rights of social media platforms. So what was the administration doing? What can they continue to do?
Well, this came out as part of a flurry of rulings that have been coming out over the last couple of days. But the Supreme Court ruled that the Biden administration can keep asking social media companies to take down posts that they view as disinformation. Going back a few years, the administration, and that means the Surgeon General's office, the FBI, CISA, a whole bunch of different agencies have asked the social media companies to take down posts about COVID-19, about the 2020 election, things that were, you know, viewed as conspiracy theories, disinformation, stuff like that. But two Republican state attorney generals and a handful of social media people sued, saying that this was an infringement on their free speech rights.
Well, what was the administration doing? Were they demanding that they, I mean, how invasive or obstructive was the administration?
Well, there was definitely a lot of communication going back and forth, if you read the legal briefs, between the administration and the social media companies. But the social media companies, you know, and as the court said in their majority opinion, they have content moderating policies that kind of mirror this kind of stuff anyway. And they continue to take down these kind of posts well after the government has kind of stopped their, you know, COVID-19 and 2020 election efforts to, you know, make sure that disinformation is not spreading on social media. So, you know, the court ruled they didn't really touch on the First Amendment issues. They just said that these parties don't have standing to sue because they haven't shown that they suffered as a result of what the administration did or could do in the future.
6-3, I presume that must have been a mix then of Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, actually, the majority opinion was written by Amy Coney Barrett, who was a Trump appointee.
Yeah, and yet Sam Alito was a dissenter. Interesting, 6-3. Well, we'll hang our hat on that and say thank you for the update. That's Bree Fowler, senior reporter at CNET. Thank you, Bree.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, 69 degrees on my phone right now. The weather app says that's what it is downtown Chicago. And sunny, it's a beautiful day. But I will say that it was really hot the other day when we started to talk about air conditioning. And I suggested that the world should make the buildings inside just a little bit warmer. I want to talk a little bit about the heat wave that we're experiencing across the country and some of the costs with Dr. Nathaniel Cohane, who is a president of the Center for Climate and Energy. Doctor, thanks for joining us on WGN. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me, John. I'm good.
I apologize. I think I didn't get your name exactly right there, did I?
No, you did it perfect. That was great.
Oh, how about that? So just pick up on my conversation there, Nathaniel. I was arguing that too often people are wearing sweaters inside buildings when it's 95 degrees outside. We would all be better if we turned the AC up a little bit. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I think the underlying issue is that it's getting hot and hotter every year. We see these record temperatures rising. It's not your imagination. I think what that means is costs to businesses, costs to households in terms of keeping buildings cool when it's getting warmer outside. I think there's lots of things we can do. I think the idea of, you know, for folks who find it comfortable, putting up the thermostat a little bit probably makes sense. But I think it's, you know, you still want folks to be comfortable. And that underlines the fundamental point, which is as we continue to put climate pollution into the air, the heat is rising, and we have to figure out how to deal with it, because these are massive economic costs that we look not just in terms of the cost of cooling, but if you look at labor productivity, if you look at supply chains, you look at agriculture, we're talking about real costs to the economy that we have to start taking account of.
You're an economist. I wonder, though, if in the past heat domes were a thing. It seems like we've only recently discovered these or talked about these, right?
Well, you know, we've always had hot days, right? But what we're seeing that's different now is because we're warming the entire world, and that's been measured. We're about 2 degrees warmer Fahrenheit globally than we were before 1950. Now, that 2 degrees doesn't sound like a lot, but what that also means is the number of hot days goes way up. The number of days above 90 degrees or 95 degrees goes way up. A small change in that average means a big difference in the extremes, and that's what we're feeling in these heat domes. So sure, we might have had a once in a century heat event that people talked about for decades. Now that once in a century event in many parts of the country might come every 10 years or every 5 years. That's what's happening as we increase temperatures, that we keep warming the climate. And so, yeah, heat domes have happened before, but they're happening much more frequently. They're happening over a broader area of the country, and they're becoming the norm rather than an outlier that we only once in a while experience.
Mm-hmm. So we notice that we're more uncomfortable, but can you put a finer point on the impact it has on the economy or businesses?
Yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line is when you add this up, this looks like it's about a percentage point or two of GDP. That's U.S. GDP. This is hundreds of billions of dollars just from heat. You start to break that down. What does that look like? Well, it's things like agriculture and crops. Crops aren't, if you have massive heat waves and real extremes, crops don't grow as well. You look at labor productivity. This is one of the big issues, not just folks working outside in the heat. Obviously, that's an issue, but manufacturing. It becomes hard to keep workplaces cool. And you can measure the loss in labor productivity, again, in the hundreds of billions of dollars. You look at spending. We mentioned before, air conditioning, that's a massive cost. Look at businesses like Walmart with huge square footage they have to keep cool. That becomes a real thing. And then infrastructure, keeping the nation's infrastructure running. I live in the Northeast. You have trains go down when the electricity, when it gets so hot that the electric grid has a hard time even to delivering some of the power to the trains. So it's really across the board. And again, you add that all up and you get to something on the order of a percentage point of GDP already, and that is climbing. That could double or multiply by more over the coming decade.
Is data storage a new wave of energy need and concern?
Well, it really is a massive area of energy use. And so you think about what are the drivers of this, right? What's driving the climate pollution that's causing the heating? Well, one of those things is energy use. If we can use clean energy, renewable energy, that doesn't a problem. But if we rely on fossil fuels, that will raise, put out the pollution and the emissions. And that massive need for data centers is putting a big load on the electric grid. And it's putting a big load in terms of finding new sources of generation and making sure they're clean and renewable. But it's also putting a big load in terms of just that resilience of the existing grid. So, yeah, the data centers, that's when you talk to experts around what are the big trends they're seeing, especially in the U.S. and the energy system, the explosion of data centers, artificial intelligence, AI, that's a big one right at the top of the list.
Well, you're the president for the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. What ideas do you have about all of this?
Well, what we do, we do a lot of work on policy, and we do a lot of work working with businesses. Our basic bottom line is there's a lot of instances in which some of the leading Fortune 500 companies in the country, that they see it in their self-interest, but also the broader interest to push for strong climate policies. I'll give you an example. One of the things we need to do is make it easier to build clean energy infrastructure in this country. There's a lot of red tape and permitting that makes it hard to build new transmission. It makes it hard to build new energy facilities or new clean energy manufacturing. So we need to reform permitting. And that's actually something that you can get support from on both sides of the aisle. There are a number of other things around that. We need to build out and clean up our industrial sector so that we can continue to lead the world, but also decarbonize that area. There are some policies there too. So what we really look to do is bring businesses and other stakeholders together to develop and advocate for policies we think can be effective and can really build a more prosperous U.S. American economy going forward in that clean energy transition.
Do you advocate for a certain kind of energy generation? Are you pro nuclear or wind or water? What should we be doing about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we are really all about emissions. We're all about limiting the amount of carbon pollution that goes into the atmosphere because that's what's driving all of these heat impacts and everything else. So when it comes to energy, for us, that means we just need more zero carbon generation. Wind and solar are great. Right now, the wind doesn't blow all day and the sun doesn't shine all day, the sun doesn't shine in the night. So we need that, but that needs to be part of a broader package. We need battery storage so that wind and solar so that we can capture that energy and put it back into the grid later. We need nuclear power, and including maybe new forms of small modular reactors. We need hydro. We need other forms. We need to figure out how to capture the carbon pollution that comes out when you burn natural gas and put it, you know, capture that so it doesn't go into the atmosphere, put it into the ground where it can remain for centuries.
Let me ask you one last question. We're just out of time, but my concern is that the electric cars aren't a panacea. I know that the infrastructure will catch up, but the power in an electric car is in a battery, and the battery power was generated by something. So there, you know, it's not as it's not a 100% energy efficient that way. What do you think about electric cars?
Well, you're putting your finger on something important, which is if you think about over time, how are we going to get carbon pollution out of transportation, out of vehicles, out of industry, out of buildings and everything? It ultimately, a lot of that comes back to building a cleaner electric grid. So right now, you're right. If you plug that car in, there might be a mix of different energy on the grid, and some of that is emitting. But over time, as we clean up that grid, the best way to also clean up transportation is going to be to have electric vehicles that plug in. But as you say, we need to clean up that grid, and we need to build the infrastructure to make it easy for people and convenient to have those vehicles.
Dr. Nathaniel Cohen is the president of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. I'm glad you're out there. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Let's have another conversation another day, doctor. But thank you for your time.
I love that. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's our pleasure. More business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your time. It's Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Walgreens stock dropped sharply after the Deerfield-based company cut its 2024 profit forecast. The pharmacy chain blames a worsening retail environment and says it'll close a significant number of its underperforming U.S. stores. Walgreens didn't say how many of the 8,700 stores might be affected. Management will also make more organizational changes but stop short of discussing further job cuts. Store closures will be part of what the company describes as a multi-year footprint optimization program. Over the last year, Walgreens shares have dropped more than 45%. A Chicago-based robotics company has raised more than $27 million in a Series A funding round. Formic Technologies has raised a total of $52 million for its robots as a service model. The company deploys robots for clients in the manufacturing sector and provides support and maintenance services. Formic helps businesses realize the benefits of automation and plans to use the added funding for U.S. and global expansion. The company was founded in 2020. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Business of Food Now with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And I got an email the other day with the headline, Wrigley Field to be powered by solar energy for first time. Really? Does that mean solar panels are going to be erected high above the friendly confines? I have an answer after we thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Wrigley Field to be powered by solar energy? Not really. Solar panels will not be erected atop the ballpark, but the company that is paying a bunch of money to be the Cubs' official solar provider says some of its community solar projects will eventually generate solar-powered electricity that will find its way into the Chicago grid and into Wrigley Field, but no solar panels there. There are more and more solar panels being erected on farmland across the country, which brings us to this fella.
My name is Jonathan Barton.
Jonathan is a founding member of the American Solar Grazing Association.
A few of us got together in 2018 and started to talk about the revolution of solar development.
And how those solar projects were taking grazing land offline with a lot of vegetation going to waste.
We saw the opportunity here for promoting the sheep industry in the context of vegetation management on solar sites.
You may be able to tell that Jonathan is a transplant from the UK, where solar grazing has been a thing for a while. In fact, in other parts of the world, it has too. And since the American Solar Grazing Association was started 8 years ago in New York, the practice has been expanding across the country.
We have a database and website, and we've got a solar grazing map, which we're gradually tapping in all the solar grazing developments throughout the country. And then we've got pockets of sheep producers who can then meet up online, essentially.
There is a little bit of solar grazing in Illinois, but the bulk of it is in the wide open spaces of the Southwest.
California and Texas are just burgeoning, thousands of acres with thousands of sheep.
And here's the good part, there's money in it for the sheep owners.
I will usually say between $300 and $500 per acre.
The American Solar Grazing Association. You can find out more at solargrazing.org. June Dairy Month continues, and today is National Ice Cream Cake Day, and it's National Onion Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
And a little while ago, we visited with Renee Krieger, the president and CEO of the Yorkville Area Chamber of Commerce. And she reminded us that the Raging Waves Water Park is the largest water park in America, and it's in Yorkville. She also told us that Skittles are made in Yorkville, but I'm not talking about that right now. In 2008, Raging Waves opened to the public, 2008, with 17 water slides, a quarter-mile-long lazy river, 350,000-gallon wave pool. They had a sand area, leisure pool, two restaurants. 15 summers later, as if that weren't enough, it's now 58 acres with 15 more water slides, 43 private cabanas, 11 dining options. This place has also been ranked as one of the cleanest parks in the United States. It's very family-friendly, of course. And it is the largest water park in the USA. Who knew? Right there in Yorkville. Just one quick note about it here. On the bio of the, or wiki page, on the page about Raging Waters, it says, ever wonder how the park got the name Raging Waves? There is one specific rock in the Raging Waves Plaza that tells the story. The rock really isn't that big, but inscribed are the words, the Lord on high is mightier than the many waters, yea, than the raging waves of the sea. It's Psalms 93:4. As owners, they say, we believe God is indeed all-powerful, and he has a hand in all we do. We choose to follow him through all of the ups and downs in life, and we know he will carry us through, even though the waves of life may be raging at times. A little bit of the background about Raging Waves. Sounds like fun, though, with all of the water, the slides, the places to eat. It's in Yorkville, and that's your hometown today.